This is Morgan Beatty speaking for Alka-Seltzer, bringing you news of the world. Tonight, International, the drums of war roll again across the Middle East. Paris, the Western powers give Soviet Russia another day to answer on Berlin. New York, the congressional Sherlocks versus the commies, Chapter 2. Philadelphia, the platform ruckus. Now a brief message from Tom Moore.
July is the month we can usually expect summer to be here in earnest. So for those hot summer days that make you feel tired, all in, and sickish, here are some suggestions that may help you get along and stand the weather much better. 1. Eat light, easily digested food. 2. Use a little more salt than usual with your meals. And 3. For the headache and the acid stomach upset that may add to your misery on a sweltering summer day, take Alka-Seltzer. Yes, dissolve 1 or 2 Alka-Seltzer tablets in a glass of water, then drink the sparkling, pleasant-tasting solution this makes. See how quickly Alka-Seltzer can ease that headache and settle that stomach upset. How Alka-Seltzer can help you feel so much better fast. When you go to your drugstore for Alka-Seltzer, buy 2 packages instead of 1 and always keep an extra package handy. Remember, an extra package on the side keeps a family well supplied. Now, Alka-Seltzer brings you the noted commentator, author, and reporter, Morgan Beatty.
The sound of serious alarms on the international stage tonight smothered the clamor of American politics. In 5 words, the soft voice of Count Bernadotte of Sweden told the hard fact: renewed struggle in the Middle East. The United Nations mediator stood before a small knot of newsmen on the island of Rhodes in the Mediterranean. He announced, "The war is on again." Even as he spoke, the new nation, Israel, issued a war communique. Egyptian forces, it said, began an offensive south of Tel Aviv using planes, artillery, armored cars. The mediator, however, was not willing to give up completely. He thought perhaps he could save Jerusalem and the holy places by a mutual Arab-Jewish agreement. Both sides have responded favorably, but not definitely. Then the Swedish peacemaker, who failed for the United Nations, indulged in a bit of philosophy, some of it pessimistic, some optimistic. War never pays, he said. The loser always loses, and the victor always loses. Both sides, Arabs and Jews, will lose, he said, in Palestine. Perhaps, he added, this is only a temporary setback. In Washington, the United States Navy has announced that 2 of our ships, the escort carrier Palau and the cargo carrier Marquette, are in Haifa to evacuate American personnel and United Nations peacemakers. In Lake Success, the United Nations Security Council met an emergency session to hunt for last-minute ways to save the Palestine truce. The United States is proposing strong action, meaning perhaps military intervention under the Charter of the UN. Another theater of conflict is demanding the urgent, round-the-clock attention of world diplomats also. In Berlin, the American and British airlift continues, but with diminishing force. Berlin's demands for heavy cargo like coal and oil are frankly not being met. The Western powers ordered power plants in their zones to cut their service again. The food situation is good, but food alone cannot stave off crisis around the corner of the calendar. The Western allies agreed tonight to wait 24 hours more for a Russian reply to their latest protest. At the end of that time, we will publish to the world our side of the case of Berlin. And after that comes action. The British left-wing journal, The Tribune, reports that the Berlin crisis is approaching a danger point that can only be spelled out with an ugly 3-letter word, W-A-R. But in Paris and Washington, the gloom is not quite so thick. For the latest view from the French capital, here recorded is Henry Cassidy in Paris.
The 3 Western powers, blockaded in Berlin by the Russians, have shown unusually kind attention today to the people who are blockading them. The United States, Britain, and France have postponed publication of their notes to Moscow, protesting against the blockade, until they are sure the Russians have received, read, and digested the contents of the messages. Publication of the notes was definitely scheduled for 4 o'clock this afternoon, Paris time. Plans for the release had gone so far that copies of the text had been mimeographed and a news conference was called at the Foreign Ministry. But the plans were canceled and the notes, delivered last Tuesday, remained officially secret. I'm told the French and British were ready to go ahead with the release, but the objection to immediate publication came from Washington. This was done although the Russians showed no hesitation in releasing immediately the last exchange of notes between Molotov and Ambassador Beadle Smith in Moscow. The reason given for the delay is a hope that the Russian reply may be favorable and diplomatic negotiations may begin. But the notes have been around so long now they cannot be considered really secret. Persons who have read the French text tell me it follows the lines already widely advertised. The important point is it does not offer to enter into the 4-power negotiations desired by Russia for a unified Germany. It does open the way to a four-power settlement of the Berlin problem, but only after traffic has been resumed between Berlin and the western zones of occupation. The note is firm against all Russian threats and pressure, and it maintains all the Allied rights in the German capital. This is Henry Cassidy in Paris.
In New York City today, the issue of communism and labor unions reached the rough and tumble stage before a congressional committee. For the accounting, here is Kenneth Banghart in New York.
For the second day, a congressional committee got no results at all here in New York on the question of communist influence in labor unions. Congressman Hartley of New Jersey expressed the hope after yesterday's session, in which three union leaders refused to say whether they were communists, that there'd be less noise and more decorum today. But today it was just as noisy, witnesses just as balky. When the committee insisted on a yes or no answer, the union officials talked about wages, working conditions, their military records, and in each case, their rights under the First and Fifth Amendments to the Constitution. Nicholas Carnes, for instance, of the CIO department store workers. Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? This confirms my opinion, said Carnes, that these hearings are intended to do the work the employers have not been able to do, frame union leaders and send them to jail. He went into a description of his first job back in 1933 in a New York store, where he said he worked 75 hours a week for $8.95. Another union official was ordered removed forcibly when he refused to say whether he'd been a member of a group that hailed the Communist Daily Worker on its 20th anniversary back in 1944. At one point, the questions got onto the presidential candidacy of Henry Wallace. Chairman Kirsten asked Jack Paley of the department store workers about pledges of his union members to contribute to the Wallace campaign. Paley replied, the members had contributed, the union itself had not. A lot of talk, but no one answered the big question the congressman came here to ask. This is Kenneth Banghart in New York.
Our own political scene reflects both sight and sound tonight and silence, the silence of strategy. That veteran Truman strategist, Clinton P. Anderson, the former Secretary of Agriculture, appeared at the White House briefly today en route to Philadelphia. He may well be burying messages to Garcia's, but all he would say was, Truman on the first ballot. And Governor Mon Walgren of Washington State, an old friend of the president's both on and off the political stage, paid a significant visit to the White House. He spent an hour with Mr. Truman. When he came out, the newsman asked him if he was a candidate for president. Said the governor, how do you become a candidate? Will you be available, was the next one. Will you be available for the vice presidency? Yes, he said, I will be available if they want me. But I'm already running for governor in my own state. House Minority Leader John McCormick is definitely available for second place, or so his friends say. And from the far southeastern corner of the country comes a voice saying, Secretary of Defense James Forrestal for Vice President. Speaking is Frank D. Upchurch, Chairman of the Florida Delegation to Philadelphia. Meanwhile, the Harmony Drive is on at the convention and not making too much headway. National Democratic Chairman J. Howard McGrath billed pre-convention conferences with James Roosevelt today and other discontented party officials. The idea is to try to smooth away some of their opposition to nominating President Truman for another 4 years in the White House. Mr. McGrath and other Truman backers are going on the assumption that General Eisenhower has said no often enough and loud enough and definitely enough so there is no chance of his being drafted as a nominee. But there's dissension in other ways in Philadelphia, too. There's the platform, the racial issue, civil rights. For that story, here's W.W. Chaplin speaking from station KYW in Philadelphia.
I watched the Resolutions Committee of the Democratic Party pick up that political hot potato, civil rights, today, and then drop it temporarily for less blistering topics like farm problems and tax matters. They'll have to come back to the hot potato, and much may depend on how it is handled, but for the moment, it's out on the windowsill to cool, they hope. This morning, spokesmen for 21 national Negro groups told the committee the Democratic Party will perish if this issue is straddled. But some Southerners say whether or not such a plank is included in the platform will determine whether a lot of delegates stay at this convention. A bolt of Southern delegates cannot yet be counted out. While the Resolutions Committee, well, not quite marks time, but at least swims in still waters before breasting the turbulent civil rights rapids, during this time of calm before the storm, the Eisenhower boom has become no more than a murmur here in Convention City. There still are ardent, diehard Eisenhower supporters. There still are flag-bedecked Eisenhower headquarters. But in Philadelphia, at least, the wise money, as the horse players call it, seems to be preponderantly for Truman in a trot, virtually uncontested. the big question mark remaining before harmony can reign in a party so recently riven is how will the Resolutions Committee handle that civil rights hot potato to make it palatable north and south? This is W.W. Chaplin in Philadelphia.
Now, around the world in a minute and a half by Dateline's Washington. The White House reports a final agreement to settle the dispute between the three operating railway brotherhoods and the carriers. The roads will be turned back to private management in a day or two, as soon as the necessary papers can be drawn up. The terms were not announced, but union leaders report the workers will get the same 15.5 cents an hour rise given to non-operating brotherhoods, plus several changes in the rules. Freight engineers and firemen, for example, will be paid for the time they wait at terminals. Washington, the striking 55,000 coal miners have been ordered to send John L. Lewis back into court to answer a charge that their failure to appear for work defies the Taft-Hartley law. Judge T. Allen Goldsboro ordered Mr. Lewis to appear in court next Wednesday to explain why an order to end the strike should not be issued. The National Labor Relations Board has asked for the order on complaint of the steel companies, the owners of the so-called captive mines. London, the jungle uprising in Malaya in the Far East, commanded the attention of the House of Commons today, the undivided attention of the lawmakers of Britain. The government considers the revolt so important that all possible forces are being mobilized to meet the rebels. Arthur Creech Jones, the colonial secretary, indirectly blamed the communists in a speech before Commons. This outbreak of terrorists, he said, is not a movement of the people of Malaya. This is the conduct of gangsters who are out to destroy the very foundations of human society and orderly life. And that's what happened around the world today.
Morgan Beatty will return with some more late news. Does your day sometimes leave you feeling irritable and upset with a headache? Well, whenever you have a headache or whenever some member of your family has one, remember Alka-Seltzer for really fast, really effective relief. Drop one or two Alka-Seltzer tablets into a glass of water, listen to it fizz, then drink the sparkling solution this makes. Since Alka-Seltzer is completely dissolved before you take it, the pain-relieving agent's ready to go to work instantly. And because of its effervescent base. Yes, because of that fizz. Alka-Seltzer gets there fast, gives fast relief. Get some Alka-Seltzer from your druggist, and remember, when you have a headache, let Alka-Seltzer help you feel better fast.
Mothers, if you're having trouble getting your children and the family to take their vitamins daily, do as Aunt Mandy does.
Yes, sir. Every time I put the food on the table, I make sure the one of Dave brand vitamin bottles on the table, too.
Why, Aunt Mandy?
Well, you see, that reminds the family to take their vitamins.
That's right. Too often meals we like are short on vitamins. Records show that 3 out of 4 people who work need extra vitamins daily. Lack of vitamins in your food may cause you to feel tired and run down, but here's how you can be sure of your daily vitamins.
Take one one-a-day brand multiple vitamin capsule every day.
Ask your druggist for one-a-day brand multiple vitamin capsules.
Now, here again is Morgan Beatty.
And here are signs of our times. Philadelphia, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, today voted to bar from membership in that society persons who are members of the Communist Party directly or indirectly. Cullman, Alabama, Governor Kissing Jim Folsom won his vindication in court today. The judge dismissed the suit that charges he is the father of Mrs. Christine Putnam Johnson's 2-year-old child. The judge held that the boy's mother started the court action for the purpose of gaining notoriety, shallow publicity, or for personal reward. Prague, Czechoslovakia. The defiant attitude of the nationalist so-called Congress toward the new communist government drew an answer today from President Clement Gottwald. The president, in effect, said the so-called men who have been praising the old anti-communist regime and parading their defiance in the streets of the capital had better watch out, or the Red Army will get them. Of course, he didn't make it quite that plain. He handled the threat with kid gloves. He had the Czechoslovakian troops pledge loyalty to him. Then he put on his uniform of commander-in-chief for the first time since he took the presidency, and he reviewed the troops. Then he delivered the punchline. An example to us, he said, is the Army of the Soviet Union, the strongest real people's democratic force in the world today. And that's the news of the world, according to Gottwald. This is Morgan Beatty speaking for Alka-Seltzer, saying goodbye from the newsroom in Washington.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.